Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. I'm Dr. Amanda Nichols. I'm a chemistry professor in Oklahoma City. And my collaborator on this project is Myron Pinner, and he's a philosopher. And so we'll be talking a little bit about philosophy of science, specifically thinking about skepticism about science philosophically and theologically. So I'm going to start today and just give an overview about how science works, talk a little bit about that, set us up about the success of science, and then Myron will take over, talk a little bit about scientific realism, and then two forms of skepticism about science, both philosophically and theologically. So in science, we are investigating nature. We think about ways of how to study that, how to describe the natural world. We're going to use the scientific method, and we'll use observation. We're going to build hypotheses based upon our observations, our data, have an experiment, and then ultimately be able to draw, you know, make theories to explain the natural world, how it's working, think about things in terms of models and laws to describe that. So some of the key features about science would be that scientists are wanting to share their methods, their data, and their results. And one of the reasons is to be able to replicate this, right? So this is a good way, as scientists, we think that we're doing our job well, is that if I can publish what I've done, and then another scientist can replicate the experiment, get similar data, we know we're doing it the right way, hopefully. One of the other key features about science that is interesting is the culture support that's needed for science to continue on this, you know, this pathway to getting better and better. So we need a huge financial investment in terms of people. We need a lot of people doing science to be able to make great strides in what we're figuring out about the natural world. We need finances for equipment, huge, you know, equipment for some types of experiments. We need a relatively stable social network, and so, you know, as cultures have evolved and everything, that's one of the features of that, is that you can have science born out of that. We can think of science in terms of the division of labor and what they study. So we have physics, chemistry, and biology. We have that realm of describing the natural world. We have, you know, the way that we conduct our scientific method. We also have the way that we study humans, and a little bit more complicated there. Sometimes is the sociology, the psychology, the anthropology divisions. And so in science, there's interesting questions lurking by. One of those might be, is there a discipline that you could just reduce down? So does everything reduce down to physics, basically, is the idea? Or, you know, some people think that at times. I'm a chemist, so my answer is no. I'll talk to you later. So another question is, are these all science, or do they study it the same way? Are they using the scientific method in the same way, especially when we think about those divisions between, you know, physics, chemistry, and biology, and sociology and psychology, maybe a relative, you know, younger field, for example. Scientific questions that we think about in terms of science and how it's working is the structural, the explanatory features of how nature works. We often require fine-grained empirical data and methods to be able to study the natural world, and so that's reflective, right? And when you do a PhD and you're going to get very, very specific in this little corner of chemistry, we're going to need a certain way to study that part of the natural world. It often requires a mathematical formal system to be able to do that as well, which is reflected in our laws. So then we have these features of science and how science works. We have this, you know, idea of how it works, the features of it, and then also the limitations or their limitations of science. So it could be that not every question can be answered by science. So we can think of it in terms of, you know, historical type of questions. So what did you do yesterday? That's kind of, you're not going to use the scientific method maybe to answer that question. In terms of values, is science a good thing? Again, that's probably, you know, science might not be able to answer that question, or if they are answering it, maybe they're not using the scientific method to do that. Why is there anything at all? So some big questions, like, why is the natural world here? Why are we able to study it? and why criteria should guide theory choice and science. So we're getting into realms, right, of philosophy of science, about theory selection and how scientists, you know, how do they pick what pathway to go down when they're thinking about how to describe the natural world. And so sometimes you might have a critic of philosophy say, well, why does philosophy matter? That would be me as an undergrad. The answer would be, I don't know, why does science matter? Well, because science, and you're doing philosophy. And so I think that's something that we keep in mind here when we're thinking about, well, not everything can be answered by science. There are scientific advances. And so one of the reasons why that works is because that we work with probabilities, but we're not certain we are open to revision. And so we think we have a correct description of how something is working or how to do something, but this might be a better way, or we can revise that as we go along, per peer review, that type of thing. There's a self-correcting feature of the scientific method. And so that idea that we publish our results and hopefully someone else will take it up and try it, and we can see if we get the same results over and over. So we're going to do that part. So I just wanted to give a quick example about the success of science and how theories and how we can have this complete picture. And so, 100 years ago, we didn't have a good idea of what molecular structure looked like. And so this is just it's just a representation of what a molecule looks like. We have a metal here in the middle, and then we have these carbonyl groups. They're carbons and oxygens coming off of it. It's symmetrical. You can look at it. I'm an inorganic chemist, so I like symmetrical molecules and thinking about it that way. And so one of the things that we are interested in as an inorganic chemist is thinking about, well, how symmetrical is a molecule? I mean, so for example, what we just saw in that animation that Myron's going to play again is that we have these rotation axes. You can rotate it, a quarter of the way around, and it looks the same before and after a rotation. There's also other types of symmetry elements is what we call them. So we can use group theory to mathematically describe the symmetry elements a molecule has. So whether it's a mirror image, a rotation axis, and then we can categorize molecules into what's called point groups. And so in a point group, every molecule in that point group has the same symmetry elements. They have the same type of rotation axis, the same sort of improper rotation or a mirror image. And when you look at these different molecules within a point group, they might look radically different. They don't look anything alike, but they have the same symmetry elements. What's interesting about that is that that helps explain some of the applications or some of the ways that these molecules behave. So one example would be that molecules, they behave a certain way in infrared radiation. And we use spectroscopy to be able to study that. And so as a result, we have a material, we can use IR spectroscopy to figure out what chemicals are in it. And the reason why that works is because of the symmetry elements. Either they have the symmetry elements or maybe a lack of, and it helps describe that. And then that leads to some other interesting theories about chemical bonding and how molecules are bonding together, and then all the way up to big ideas about what works in some applications in medicine, for example.
All right, so we have this overview of science in kind of big picture terms. I hope you're motivated to see that science is incredibly successful, and just this, the more that we learn, perhaps the more we realize we don't know, but we're able to kind of utilize this knowledge in very, very detailed and fine-grained ways that are incredibly successful in ways that we just assume as part of our modern world. So let's talk about scientific realism then. And basically the realist intuition about science is quite intuitive for many, which is to say that the success of science, right, is good reason to think that the scientific picture is true or approximately true, right? Because science works so well that we have this fine-grained information about how certain features of the natural world work, we're able to describe it in laws and seem to be very comprehensive and successful into applications all the way down the line. The success of science is a good reason to think that the picture that science is giving us is accurate, or highly accurate, true or approximately true. Now, scientific realists, and this kind of description of the realist approach to science that we're adopting is from a philosopher by the name of Stathis Psilos. He has a really nice way of describing kind of the realist sensibility as a conjunction of three stances, right? So when it comes to the basic structure of reality or metaphysics, the realist thinks, well, look, the world has a definite mind-independent, natural-kind-like structure, right? So, you know, regardless of how we kind of bring our own cognition to experience the world is what it is in a mind-independent, objective way. Semantically, then, when it comes to the theories of science, these are, you know, going to be true or false depending on how the world is, right? They're going to be truth-conditioned descriptions of their intended domain. And here's also an interesting part about scientific realism. The realist thinks that that's also the case when it comes to the unobservables of science, unobservable to the naked eye. We can't just go out and observe the Higgs boson in order to test for it. We have to bring all sorts of assumptions to the table in terms of what we're testing. However, the realist thinks that, yeah, insofar as we're able to have successful science, even at the level of subatomic particles, that's a pretty good reason to think that that picture that we're getting is true or approximately true. And then epistemologically, the realist thinks that given, you know, this metaphysical and semantic stance, our mature and predictably successful theories are reliable guides to our thinking about what's true of the world, right? So this is kind of a nice way of describing kind of the realist sensibility. And we can summarize this maybe in a very simple kind of argument. Consider some mature and highly successful scientific theory T. Well, successful in the sense that it makes very fine-grained and specific predictions that we are then subsequently go out and able to confirm. Not to verify with logical certainties, as Amanda talked about earlier in terms of scientists working probabilities and openness to revision. However, very fine-grained and accurate predictions. Well, the realist just thinks, look, the best explanation for this successful prediction is the fact that it is, you know, that this theory is in the main approximately true, right? The best explanation for what we're observing in one is the truth of the theory in question, and so therefore we have good reason to think that the theory is true or approximately true. So this is just kind of a way of thinking realistically about the project of science. And again, there are some qualifications though, right? Being a scientific realist does not preclude theories getting revised over time, right? We talked earlier about scientific method, you know, being open to revision and new data. It doesn't preclude even theories getting replaced by even better successor theories. I mean, one of the unfortunate consequences, I think, of the way a lot of people read Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions is this notion of incommensurability between paradigms in the history of science, and I think that's a bad way of reading the history of science with respect to the logic of scientific revolutions and paradigm shifts. So being a realist doesn't preclude theories getting replaced by even better theories as they go along. And it also, and this is important to note, and for those of you who do work in sciences, you have there's a burden that you bear when it comes to translating science to a wider audience, given the way that science is used to kind of attach to lots of different kinds of activities. Being a realist doesn't mean that everything that goes by the name of science is on equal footing, right? So Amanda referenced this division of labor among sciences, and, you know, younger sciences, or depending on their domain of study, or, you know, human sciences are, you know, there's so many variables that we just don't understand that, you know, sociology is not physics, right, in that respect. It doesn't mean that it's not science per se, or that there's not interesting continuities between social sciences and natural sciences. It's just that there's a qualitative difference there. All right, so, I mean, I'm tempted to say who are the realists, who are the anti-realists, and kind of separate the sheep among the goats, but we're not going to do that. However, I mean, I'm inclined towards a scientific realist picture. I think the argument sketch that I gave before is very plausible to me. It's it's hard for me to know what could best explain the success of science in these fine-grained and detailed ways over and 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 over again without it being the case that the picture that's presented to us is true or approximately true, right? However, not everyone is a realist, sadly to say, but that's we'll have a good discussion about that. So one of the most prominent objections philosophically to scientific realism in the realm of philosophy goes by the name of the pessimistic induction or pessimistic meta-induction. And here the objector says something like this: well, look at you, science person. Science is contingent and provisional, and the history of science is a graveyard of rejected theories, even theories that seem to work well. Why should we have the confidence in our contemporary science, even though it seems to work? The history of science gives us good reason to think that our current science is wrong, so we shouldn't think that the picture of the world delivered by a science now has to be true. And this is, again, I think part of the legacy of reading Kuhn a certain way, and in theologically informed circles, it's appropriated in a way that we'll get to in a minute. But here's kind of our response to this philosophically motivated objection to science. And it references comments I made earlier. We think that there's good reason to think that the history of science is not one of successive failed theories, but rather truth transfer from less accurate theories to more accurate and comprehensive theories. And we have some papers in which we've explored this in greater detail in the history of chemistry, where, for example, you look at early models of the structure of the molecule in inorganic compounds, particularly cobalt complexes, were based on the more developed organic chemistry models, where models are kind of molecules are seen to be these hydrocarbon chains. But it turns out that thinking of certain inorganic compounds as chains did lead to correct kind of predictive results in some cases, but not in all. And when molecular structure was conceived of radically differently, it had much better results. And that was gives us a good reason to think that that's more accurate. However, when you look at, well, why did the failed model get the right result in some cases? Well, it didn't get everything wrong. And it turns out that the features that led to this predictive success of the wrong model actually survived into the successor model, right? So what you have then is not complete paradigm shift incommensurability between failed model and correct model. You've got kind of this truth transfer from a picture that's accurate in some respects, but not in every, and it gets moves on forward. So you stick with 3 minutes?
Okay.
Yeah, we're good. So this idea that, we get this ever-increasing glory in the scientific progress, I think. All right, here's a quotation from Silas. It kind of makes the same point. And I also think this is another point worth making. We feel that the success of science today is qualitatively different than from the success of science, centuries ago. If you think mid-19th century to today and the vast increases that we have in chemistry and physics and biology in particular, it's qualitatively different than failed models from, let's say, a millennia ago. Finally, then, just on theologically based skepticism about science, one might think, well, look, science isn't the only way of forming beliefs about the world. We've got the Bible, God's Word revealed. And because of who God is, loving and all-knowing, we can have much more confidence in God's word than in science. Truths revealed by God are eternal and unchanging, whereas science changes all the time, right? This idea that science keeps changing over time, and that's seen to be a problem with science, whereas theology is eternal and unchanging. Here, this is an argument that we call the Moeller schema. We dub it the Moeller schema because it seems to reflect the thinking of Al Moeller, who is the president of the largest Southern Baptist seminary. The Moeller schema kind of goes like this: according to science, P; according to my Bible-based theology, P is false. Therefore, P is false. Right? And this is not really an overly simplistic reduction of Moeller's thinking. Here's a quotation from Moeller after in a podcast that he did after the confirmation of gravitational waves from the LIGO experiments. Now, to be candid, I don't believe the world is 1.3 billion years old, certainly not billions of years old. I don't believe it's actually millions. But one of the interesting things we need to note is that the scientists who believe it because they're looking at certain patterns that tell them that. We need to note that if we were operating ourselves from a simply materialistic and naturalistic worldview, we would probably come to the same conclusions. And Moeller goes on to say, you know, but we have the Bible, we have a theological, we have a Christian worldview, which tells us that we ought to reject the materialistic, naturalistic picture from science, right? And so thus, you know, science may say P, but Bible-based theology says that P is false, therefore P is false. Well, quickly then, just in conclusion, obviously there are some responses that we can make theologically, you know, theological pluralism. Many Christians have theological models which can affirm both science and the Bible. I think, you know, the last plenary was an excellent model for us in that regard. Epistemic pluralism. The Bible is one epistemic authority among many to guide our thinking. You can't isolate the Bible from reason, tradition, and experience. You're always bringing these other sources along into our interpretation. So it's a false dichotomy to try and live the Bible over and above these other authorities. And finally, you still have the success of science, right? You still have the phenomenon that needs to be explained, right? And so just to appeal to the Bible as a way of rejecting, you know, the success of science out of hand, you still have to account for, well, then if it's not because it's true, why does it work? If it's not because the picture in the main is correct, how is it that we're able to get these correct results? So that's our paper.
Thank you. As I've encountered another form of theological science skepticism,
yeah,
it goes something like, we are fallen, so our intellect is fallen.
Yeah.
So we can't actually approach the natural world with a degree of confidence.
Yeah.
A pragmatic view of science,
yeah,
not a realistic.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that particular theological objection?
I guess the question is, does that range over our theological models as well as our scientific models? And if it does, then, you know, it cuts both ways. You know, unless the spirit somehow guides our theology and not our science, and I don't know why we should think that that's true.
Another typical theological response to science is, well, that's just how it looks. We know that it's actually like this, similar to it, but Moore would say things like that. My response has usually been, well, but God is a God of reality and of created things, which he actually makes. And so why would we want to resort to a God of appearances? And it just seems so problematic to trust in appearances as if that is reality. When you think about the implications of spreading that, to say the incarnation, Jesus Christ looked human, he really wasn't. In fact, that's at the core of Henry Morris's theological perspective. Well, I don't give any comments about that.
I think the similar kind of thing applies in the same way, right? So suppose that's right, and that we should be, you know, realize that, you know, in our scientific descriptions of nature, well, that's just kind of how they appear to us, but really there's something else. Well, in our theological descriptions of, like, why should we think that the, you know, being subject to just appearances is only available in science and not theology? Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, it's you would know this, you know, teaching science, but it's a heavy, heavy burden to place on these students. And you think, well, epistemically, you know, science has this self-correcting feature in it that if you are just kind of being mistaken and being misled by things appearing a certain way, at least there's this self-correcting methodology that over time it's going to find you out. What analogous feature is there in theology to protect you from error? Right? You know, I mean, there might be some features in theology that can guard you from error over time, but they're not nearly as reliable as what we've seen in science. So the fact that scientists revise their views over time, that's a feature. It's not a bug. It doesn't mean that something's gone wrong. It means that it's working. Right? And where's the analogous methodology in science? Yeah. Oh, sorry, Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Jim's got the chair.
Okay.
Might be short. So I think I kind of hear you distinguishing finiteness and fallenness. Is that fair?
Okay.
No, that's not my main question.
Yeah.
Actually,
okay. Yeah.
Jump back. Yeah. Just really quickly. So you one of your responses was that there's a qualitative difference, and so the normal pessimistic meta inductions are like Fallerick and Forrest and Eric.
Yeah.
Right. And so what are, can you just speak briefly to some of the qualities that you see as being different? Because that's a pretty strong word to say. There's a qualitative difference between Forrest and etc.
Part of it, I think it goes back to that, the idea that there's this truth transfer, that there's features that are getting carried on between, you know, a revised theory. So it's not just a complete difference from one to another.
Well, I mean, you could speak, but I mean, it's, you know, think of like, you know, curves of population growth, like, and all of a sudden, boom, right? Or like, you know, global temperatures, and then the spike, right? And I think there's an a similar kind of curve when it comes to our understanding of some very key building blocks of the natural world. It's kind of, you know, progress, but all of a sudden you get, I mean, you know, structure of the atom, and then you know, those set of papers in the early part of the 20th century from Einstein and others on quantum, and then it's like, you know, and I think just the array of tools that we have to analyze data, to do experiments, to probe the cosmos at the very large scale and the small, that like even just, it just gives us so much more and better data. Like just simply in virtue of that fact alone, I think you can argue that that's, you know, that just gives us tools that they just didn't have, right? So there's a qualitative difference between, you know, for example, first microscopes and telescopes to what we have today, right? In terms of the ability we have to confirm across, particularly natural sciences, experimental results. There's a convergence that we have that I think is analogous to that spike up.
Yeah.
It was a different era, right?
Yeah. But I don't know, it seems that it can be a little bit too locked in the present, mm-hmm. but to say that, you know, ours is qualitative.
I hear what you're saying. I hear your argument, actually.
sort of locked into current understanding as preferencing.
Well,
in 100 years, we'll look archaic.
Well, I think that point about qualitative difference reflects a skepticism about that, right? And that's, I mean, the great things about promissory notes is that who's gonna cash them, right? So, if successive generations kind of look back and realize we're all crap, well, you know, so be it.
Thanks, Mark. I'm just responding to your question. What kind of self-directing features are there in theology?
Yeah.
Right. And when we're trying to look at science and faith and try to integrate them, wouldn't it be similarly that if you test it on yourself, if it works or not? So there's this idea that your theology affects your personal identity, just as if what Catherine said last night, look, it's us, it's bad, you know. I don't like this scientific facts because it's impinging on my personal identity.
It's a cost. Yeah, I mean, we have a paper under review in which we kind of flesh out this kind of theological objection a little more fully, and we talk about this kind of epistemic pluralism, you know, the interplay of our interpretations of scripture and our traditions and reason, but also our own experience, and this idea that if there is a self-correcting method in theology, it is these different voices in dialogue and being able to inform one another. So that I think when we look at, for example, tradition if we look to tradition to give us certain answers that tradition isn't wired to give, then it's going to lead us to error. I think a way of making your point too is if we ignore impacts on our own experience, that's also going to lead us down the way. So I think you know, it's not as clear a self-corrective method as what we get in science, but there is, I think, something analogous there where these different voices in dialogue with each other.
It's like a theory that dies when a new one can be born.
Yeah.
It's this principle of death and resurrection that holds because of the information. Mm-hmm. That's what we believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, so I don't, I mean, we don't want to dismiss the notion of theology as a way of thinking about the world. It's just that we need to give science the respect that it deserves, in our view, and it's, and not any more, but certainly not any less. And we think that the anti-realist perspectives, whether it's philosophically or theologically based, fail to respect the incredible success of science. Mm-hmm.
James, I was just going to mention that in the other room, they've extended this session to 12:35. If you want to go longer, I think we could.
Although we've got to jump on the lunch line if we went now.
Well, I think we have a motion on the floor, all in favor.
When you're anti-realist, I'm not sure when the time is.
What is time?
Can I ask a question about the metaphysical component of realism? Okay, so you're committed to mind-independent reality.
Yeah.
Don't you, to be a realist, don't you also have to be committed to the mind-dependent aspect of reality? Because, you know, observation affects reality in interesting ways.
Sort of quantum.
Yeah, so don't you have to update the notion of realism to embrace how the mind-dependent is woven together with the mind-independent? And wouldn't that result in being more of a pragmatic approach to realism, or as Charles Peirce conceives it, pragmaticism? Any comment on that?
Yeah. So Silosian realism is one kind of flavor of a realist kind of picture, but there are different ways of thinking about it. One account is to talk about, one question that, what are we realists about? Are we about entities, or are we about the mathematical structures that describe laws, or some combination of both? Like, what is it that we're realist about? And structural realists, for example, will say that, no, we shouldn't be realists about the entities, and that those can kind of change over time as we kind of, our understanding changes, but the mathematical formal structures, that's what we're actually entities about. The role of the observer in, I think there's still kind of open questions about how much metaphysics we need to take into that. We'll have to think more about that. Pragmaticism is interesting.
I saw someone like this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was more like.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you.